double helix, the DNA spontaneously bends toward the neutralized side. And to put the perspective on, the historical perspective on this, I can just read a little bit of the first paragraph there. What would happen to the structure of DNA if the charges on one side of the helix were selectively neutralized? This question posed earlier by Mirza Bekov and Rich. Mirza Bekov, a biologist in Moscow, and Rich, a well-known MIT biologist. That was in 1979. And then analyzed theoretically by me and co-workers. The co-workers in this case were Mirza Bekov and Rich. Has now been given an experimental answer by Strauss and Maher on page 1829 of this issue. So the occasion of this commentary was the experimental, very beautiful experimental work of Jim Maher, at that time at the University of Nebraska and now at the Mayo Clinic, and his student Julie Strauss. That was 1994. The motivation for this was to try to understand better the energetics of binding of DNA to the nucleosome, but I won't put it in that context. I'd like to review the theory that we devised to show that this rather obvious idea that if you neutralize on one face, that the phosphates on the other face would drive the spontaneous bending. Is in fact a significantly large effect. It could be insignificantly small. So that's the point of the theory. And we'll start with the statement that charged groups on a polyion being modeled as a single lattice of charged sites, just a line of charges. Charged groups on such a polyion create a stretching force. Now you'll have to get the picture of flexible bead models out of your minds. We're talking about DNA in this case on a persistence length scale. So you should be thinking about stiff rods and not flexible beads. So for a linear lattice of spacing B, I earlier had derived an expression for the stretching force due to the charges. They're like charges. They push each other away, so they're stretching the DNA. G is the free energy. C is the usual charge density parameter. B is the charge spacing of the lattice. Okay, these are familiar definitions. Now, in the case of, if we're trying to understand something about asymmetric charge neutralization, a single lattice is not sufficient. We need at least two lattices. So here's one, and here's the other, and the little circles are charges. And on the bottom, and this might represent, say, one strand of the DNA. Forget the double helix. So the charge spacing there is 3.4 angstroms. And here's the other strand. And then one selectively neutralizes this phosphate and this phosphate. And if we try to think in mechanical terms, what would happen? You have a stretching force on both lattices because the phosphates are repelling each other. If you imagine the charge neutralization as occurring instantaneously, then at that instant, before the structure has a chance to respond to the neutralization, the restoring force is still there. You've neutralized the stretching force is opposed by a restoring force to maintain the equilibrium structure of the system. That restoring force stays there at that instant. But then, of course, immediately drives the DNA into a new mechanical equilibrium. That's the basic idea. And that's what this delta FH is. It's the driving force. toward the new mechanical equilibrium. And then the question is that new structure bent? So the trick is to, because the only thing I really have in the theory is for a single lattice, is to construct a reasonably equivalent single lattice of effective spacing B. So we have the on the free side, the charge, the lattice that's not neutralized, the free side, that stays constant at 3.4 angstroms. But on the other side, the charge spacing increases by a factor in the denominator, 1 minus alpha, where alpha is the degree of neutralization of the phosphate charges. The effective value of B is then the total length of the rod divided by the total number of charged groups, the usual definition, and the NH, H is for histone. Think of H as standing for neutralized. That's the neutralized side. H for neutralized. So it depends on alpha. And if you take reciprocals, you get this relation for the effective value of B. Charge spacing. And then one can differentiate the free energy with respect to the length of the neutralized side. What happens when you actually when you're stretching, the number of charge groups stays the same, so that doesn't get differentiated. It's the spacing. That's the variable here. And the answer that one gets for the stretching force on the neutralized lattice is this. So let's see, does this make sense? If alpha is zero, in other words, if you haven't done anything, the stretching force on the neutralized, the stretching force on one of those two lattices, on one side of the DNA, is half of the total, which makes sense. And when you fully neutralized, you have no stretching force. But this is a fairly complicated expression because as a function of the degree of neutralization, because alpha also appears in the free energy itself. And then you form the difference between the stretching force, the large stretching force when alpha is zero, and the diminished stretching force at some variable alpha, and it's that portion of the overall stretching force that has the compensating restoring force is equal and opposite to this to this difference. Let's skip the other one, which is a 10% effect. So we now have this picture. Here's the restoring force, and incidentally, this segment of DNA should be imagined as being embedded in more DNA that's coming out this way, because otherwise otherwise it wouldn't make any sense. Otherwise, the forces would not materialize as elastic forces. But here's your restoring force after neutralization, and the question is now, what do we do with it? Well, we go consult some, or at least that's what I did with it. We consulted some engineering textbooks and found that if you have an eccentrically placed load on a rod, this is the eccentricity, the restoring force is off the line of centers. If it were on the line of centers, then it's a different problem. But we're talking about neutralizing the charge on one face of the DNA. Let's skip down. Forget this part. This complicates it, and only by 10%. But this is what we actually did. This gives the essential idea. Here is the radius of curvature. It doesn't bend to a circle. I mean, I've made a lot of simplifications in the cartoons. It bends to a sine wave. So this is the maximum radius of curvature in the middle of the sine wave. Here's your eccentricity, which for DNA would be 10 angstroms because the total diameter is 20 angstroms. So you're setting it off. You're going to one side. So that makes E 10 angstroms. F is the force. B is the Hooke's law bending constant for the rod. We get that from experimental measurements of the persistence length. So that's an empirical obtainable parameter from experiment. And then we use that formula. To get results like this, this is radius of curvature as a function of the extent to which one has neutralized one side of the DNA. Take a 20 base pair segment. You see the sensible result that the radius of curvature diminishes, in other words, more bending, as you increase the amount of curvature. And specifically for the Strauss-Maher experiment, the length was 6 base pairs. It was a 0.045 molar. And the result we get, and it was fully neutralized. 6 base pairs were fully neutralized, so alpha is 1. And we get a bend of 9 degrees.
You have divided 3 in this result?
Yeah. Yeah, that's in the very first expression for the free energy. There was a kappa B. That's already taken into account. So we get a 9-degree bend, and the point of that is that it's significant. It's a significant bend. Konstantin Kosakov has recently finished his thesis, as part of which he did an all-atom simulation of this bending and energy computation. So there are some nice pictures that result. In his simulation, in the experiment, the neutralization was accomplished across the minor groove. I mean, there's a lot of detail in all atom models, so it's this one. Konstantin is able to neutralize in many different ways. He can just set the charges equal to zero, or he could actually put methyl groups on the phosphates, which chemically is what Strauss and Maher did, at least in their first variant of this experiment. He can neutralize in many permutations here. You could put the phosphate has two oxygens, and you could put a methyl group on either one of those, and there are 6 of them, so they're all, you can do all of that on the computer. Or you can bend across the major groove, which was not done in the initial experiment, or you could try bending across the major groove. Anyhow, this shows you clearly what is meant by one face of the DNA, because all 6 of these neutralizations are you can see them. There's the other side of this. You can't see the other side, but you can see all 6 sites of neutralization. And his results, he has lots of tables containing a huge amount of structural detail. But this is a nice summary of the results. One of these thick arrows is the average of all these different ways of neutralizing, and they all give different bends. But when you take the average, you get about 11 degrees toward the, bottom is across the minor groove. That's where the experiment was, so let's concentrate on that one. It's all skewed toward the minor groove. In other words, the bending, there is bending of about 10, 11, 12 degrees, and it is in the direction of the neutralized face in the all-atom simulation.
Is there also a twist of the DNA?
There are structural changes in every structural parameter. There's twist that changes the buckling of base pairs, the sliding of base pairs, the tilting of base pairs, and all of those are tabulated in Kosakov's thesis. That's not a friendly question. I mean, to me. Yeah, but well, okay, then the answer is no, I can't tell you too much about the detail. How are the, oh, okay, I can tell you that, yeah. There were no counter ions. The phosphates have a charge of -1 before neutralization. The simulation is done without counter ions. So it's -1, which then gets neutralized. Yeah. That was a friendly question because I knew the answer to it. Was there any other?
Well, maybe friendly, maybe not friendly. What does the experiment actually do?
The experiment actually ran these neutralized, partially neutralized DNAs through a gel. And this is a very highly developed field in the, among DNA biophysics and biochemists. You measure the mobility, and one has ways of calibrating whether it's against known bends, because specific sequences are known to be intrinsically bent, having nothing to do with charge neutralization. So you know mobility is a function of bend, and you can tell direction. It's a very elegant experiment. That's the basis of it.
How do they neutralize any one side? Or?
That's you can do that either by methylating. You can tether cations to the phosphate groups. They've done that. I guess those are the two that I'm familiar with. Oh gee, that's not a friendly question. Right? But they do. They do. I mean, that's that. No, it wasn't that complicated. Well, I don't know. I just don't know.
You can selectively methylate any phosphate group along DNA you want, anyone you care to. Biochemists know how to do that.
Yeah, that's a good way of answering it. That they do know how to do that. Yeah.
A semi-friendly question,
but it's dielectric. It's dielectric constant water.
Without electrolyte ions.
Without electrolyte ions. Yeah. Okay, so that finishes up that topic. We'll be trying to do some further work on it, but for now that's it. Now I'd like to go on to another topic. And I'd like to show you a simulation I have the reference written here if anyone wants it. This is from David Beveridge's simulation group. It's DNA. It's an all-atom it's a mammoth simulation. It's an all-atom simulation. They also have its counterpart in molecular dynamics with similar results. And the point of my showing this is that one sees the counter ion distribution as being broken into two distinct populations. In this case, green for positive. The greens are the counter ions. There are many of them because it's a superposition of many snapshots to get an overall picture. So there's the side view and the top view. And you see the two populations. You see the condensed layer. Show the double helix. Yeah, they follow the phosphates. Yeah.
Is this sodium?
Sodium, yeah. Yeah. He did add salt, but as far as I know from just what I recall from the papers, no. In this case, there's just what the picture I'm showing you here, there are no chlorides, just the sodium counter ion.
There is a trap power in the middle.
Are you referring to this?
Yeah. In the middle.
So you're seeing through the two helices, basically.
Yeah.
What's that? Is it the middle major groove, or?
Well, here you see, this is the major groove here and the minor groove over there. Major,
yeah,
major,
like
minor. Well, I mean, the counter ions do not follow the phosphates exactly. They're averaged out, but enough so that you can see it, as Vic saw it. Yeah. Yeah. This is I have it written in a place where you can't see it. It's Young, Jayaram, and Beveridge. If you remember the name Beveridge, it's his group. Journal of the American Chemical Society. Volume 119, 1997.
Why do they get so many?
Because they superimpose many snapshots.
Oh.
Yeah.
So statistics.
Statistics, yeah. Okay. Moving on to some of our work. I'm gonna put this one aside. Let's see. I'd like to introduce a terminology. If it sticks, good. If it doesn't, I don't know. Absolute salt effect. It's supposed to capture your attention. The idea is not, it's Jayaram's and Beveridge's. It comes from another paper of theirs, and I'm going to be speaking about that paper at some length. But to introduce it, consider a homework exercise in limiting law Debye-Huckel theory, not full Debye-Huckel theory, even just limiting law Debye-Huckel theory. Debye-Huckel attraction between a sodium ion and a chloride ion in aqueous sodium chloride. So your potential of mean force is your minus e to the minus kappa r over r. At some cutoff distance, just think of this as contact between sodium and chloride, r naught. It's the same thing except at r naught. The direct part of the, can I call this the direct potential? The Coulomb potential without screening is u of r and u of r naught. And now let's define delta g of free energy. Delta G Beveridge for the delta G Jayaram Beveridge, delta G Beveridge, as the following. The first term here, the difference, is the work required to bring the sodium and chloride ions from distance R to distance R naught. And then from that, you subtract the direct part of that work. You subtract the Coulomb law, the unscreened part of that work. So that's why I call it the absolute salt effect. And your reference is at contact. It's not at infinity is the point. So there are two things. In words, this is this delta G Beveridge is the contribution of screening ions to the work of bringing a sodium and a chloride from R to R naught. As the homework exercise, calculate delta G Beveridge in the limit that R naught goes to zero. And there's no problem with divergence, and you get this little expression. And I've plotted that out for you, for myself, and then pass it on. So delta G Beveridge, that little expression I just had, looks like this. And there are two things to notice about it. The first is that it's always positive. And that means that screening, ordinary Debye-Huckel screening, ordinary Debye-Huckel linear screening, weakens the attraction between a sodium and a chloride. That's the meaning of the positive sign. You're increasing the free energy from the direct Coulomb attraction. It's screening. Okay. The second thing to notice is that that effect increases when you increase the concentration. When kappa goes from 0.1 to 0.2, you weaken the attraction more. Increased concentration or increased screening increases the amount by which the attraction is weakened. Sorry about that. Increases the weakening. More screening. Okay. So that's I do that just to set the framework of expectation. Now, another paper from the Jayaram Beveridge axis, and this one I really like because it's so interesting. The results are so interesting. Here's your reference. Here they did the following, and I just have to take up some of my time explaining what they did. It's the binding of a protein, namely lac repressor, to DNA. So the sodium ion is the protein, which has 13 positive charges and 12 negative charges, net charge of plus 1. And your chloride is the DNA. Those are the two entities that are coming together as a function of distance. Now, what's plotted over here in this figure is delta G Beveridge. They didn't call it that, of course. And that means the following, that the number you get at a particular distance, like at 20, so this number, this is the work of bringing the protein, let's say the DNA is fixed at the origin, so I can talk a little bit more easily. The DNA is fixed at the origin. So this is the work of bringing the protein from 20 angstroms away from its binding site to its binding site. It's that work. But it's delta G Beveridge, so it's only the contribution to that work of the small ions that are included in the system. So he has sodium and chloride ions in there also. So it's only the contribution of the small ions. Now, it's not a... when I say it's the work, it's the ionic part of the work. It's the purely ionic part of the work. How did they do this specifically in the simulation? You have energy terms. So what did they include in the energies? Only pair interactions between two ions. That's the first thing to say. It's the only thing that's included in the energy. Like an interaction between a sodium and a chloride. There's an interaction between an aspartate, a negative charge on the protein, and a sodium. There'll be an interaction between a phosphate and a chloride, or a phosphate and a sodium. They include all of those. They leave out the interactions between the phosphate and the aspartate, the direct Coulomb between the protein and the DNA. And that's what's being plotted here. Several things to note. Maybe I could really make some use of this. If I could turn it on. But there, the obvious button. So there's the bihookal linear screening. So one thing, here's zero. Where's zero? Here. This is zero. Obviously, this has to be zero, zero work. So I wish I had drawn a line across. But you could see that this part of the curve at far distances is positive, and it's concave down, and it looks like linear screening. So you can notice that. But then you can notice a qualitative difference. It dips down and becomes negative, hits a minimum, goes back up. Negative, the opposite from linear screening, opposite behavior from linear screening. Then it gets even more complicated when you go over here. Here you have counter ions only. Here they've added salt. So here you have a dilute in small ions, increasing concentration of small ions, still more small ions, and so on. Look at the crossover. So look at this part over here, which over here just looked like ordinary Debye linear screening. But what you see, there's an inverted salt dependence. As you increase concentration, the effect diminishes. Physically, as you increase concentration, you increase the attraction between your cation and your anion. It's the opposite of what you expect. Okay. Now let me replace this by this. Keep this.
This is all from some sort of simulation.
This is a simulation. Okay, so we decided to have a crack at that data with our way of approaching polyelectrolyte theory. And this calculation was done by Jolly Ray. And for us, in this model, in this initial calculation, we used a small divalent ion to represent the protein. Why divalent? Because there's a measure by which you can tell experimentally that the protein behaves in some ways like a divalent ion. So there's some motivation for choosing n equals 2. And I have to tell you a little bit. I mean, depending on how much time I have, I'll try to go into the underlying theory. But I have to tell you a little bit. We know how, within the framework of our model at least, we know how to calculate the potentials of mean force between two charged objects, a charged rod and either two charged rods or a charged rod and a counter ion, or a charged rod and a co-ion, and even something more complicated, which I'll show you. And we're trying to work on being able to handle more and more complicated objects, but we're always going to have this at least one charged rod. The calculation is limited in this, so far at least, we have to make it separately for three regions of space: near distances, far distances, and intermediate distances. And that's why some of the things I'm going to show you aren't smooth curves. Okay, let's just look at the far distances over here for three different salt concentrations. Am I pointing to it properly? Yeah, I have to go directly up here. Where is it?
The other corner.
Ah, yeah, that's what I need. Here, this model captures the inverted salt dependence. As you go up in salt concentration, you increase the attraction between the divalent counter ion and the DNA. So the opposite from linear screening, 0.025 to 0.05 to 0.1. That was a surprise to us, actually, that it was in the far region, because we had previously gotten peculiar effects in the intermediate region. That was what was for us different. But then I realized that it's not just far region. Because of the way that delta G beverage is defined, this includes the near region also. These numbers include, it's a difference between far and contact, which is in the near region. And the near region has some properties that are, when you put the two together, at any rate, this is the result.
The co-ion is the same as the counter-ion from the rod or not? Is it any salt or?
We have sodium chloride. So we have our small divalent ion, our DNA, and sodium chloride in the calculation. Well, I was wondering whether people would be interested in that or not. I mean, don't you find it interesting that that they get this opposite?
No, because I think if I take, something that's overwhelming in one direction apart and then supple things, I can always find things that go up and down in ways that are hard to understand.
Well, we're trying to understand those subtle things. I mean, usually we get criticized in the opposite direction. This is the first time. I mean, I'm crushed because this is the first time we're really trying to explain some subtle things. Well, let me go on, and because I can't back up now. And the scale is completely off. Notice these numbers and compare them with these numbers of 1.2 2.1. Scale is completely off. That's one thing. The other thing is this. This is the far region. This is the intermediate region. And then this is the near region. It doesn't stand out too much because it's flat at zero. There's an exact cancellation in the delta G beverage difference. And so we don't get this. We get this. Just a flat line over there. So this small counter ion is capturing this subtle effect, possibly for real physical reasons, possibly coincidentally. That I can't tell you. But there are other things that it's certainly not getting. So we've gone on to more, ever more subtlety. And, Nancy Markey actually had the idea that, look, we're dealing with a protein. It's not a divalent ion. It has some negative charges on it. So let's make the model a little more complicated. So here we have, we want to call this a dipolar ion. It's 2 angstroms long. The negative end, which is further away from the DNA, has a charge of -1. And the positive end has a charge of 1.05. Why 1.05? Well, remember 13 positive charges and 12 negative charges. And 13 over 12 is, I think, about 1.08. So that's the ballpark. And we can do this calculation. We bring this protein closer and closer to the DNA. And you see we get these in lots of crossovers, some of which are right and some are wrong. This remains. The capturing of the inverted salt dependence in the far region remains. The solid line is the dilute. The dashed line is concentrated. So you go down in You go up in concentration, you increase the attraction. Crosses back over here, which was also true of Jolly's result. That's just not seen in the, what we're predicting is a crossover someplace out here, which is just not in their data. Apparently they didn't do that. That's a very clear result of our, so that's something that somebody should do. To check whether there's another crossover over here, and you go back to the bihookal-like screening.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
If the divalent ion for your model protein is far from the DNA, you expect it to have some salt ions of itself surrounding it, trying to complex. As you get close to DNA, it will lose them, presumably, right? It gets blown up by the...
Yeah, that should be, with these particular...
Is that a kink?
No, we don't have that. We just don't have that in the model. And there's zero, almost zero net charge over there. And even for a divalent ion, it's a pretty small effect. The ion pairing and whatnot for small ions is much smaller than DNA ion effects. So, okay, we get the minimum. And we're getting the minimum for very subtle reasons that we don't understand at this point. These are very new results. We haven't really dissected the equations. I can't really tell you why we get the minimum. We've tacked on a negative charge, and we get a minimum. We don't get zero anymore. The scale is about right, amazingly enough. The scale is about right. The only thing that's qualitatively wrong here is that the salt dependence is not the same as the we get an inverted salt dependence over here, which is not seen in the beverage simulation. Over in here you get the expected salt dependence. When you go more concentrated, you go up, whereas over here we go down. So I don't want to make exaggerated claims about this. Just to give you an idea of what we happen to be doing, this particular result is a week old. I just thought you'd want to know what we're doing.
I'm just reading the far charge, and so the near charge is attractive, and the far charge is also overall salt gives you attraction. When you add salt, you this is compared to the screen length, you don't get the far charge, but the near charge is always attractive.
It may well be something like that. I mean, what's built into the theory is actually more complicated than screening, but it's possible that you have something like that.
Discrete.
Discreteness of which charge?
Well, all the screening charges. I mean, in the simulation, I'm presuming they put in the counter ions and so on.
Yes. Yes, yeah.
And yeah. So you get Dirac effect coming in.
Yeah.
You increase the counter ions, there's only so many that can fit around.
Yeah.
And then the entropy factors come in quite a big way, which are left out of
this theory.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would have always expected some sort of
Well, that's we don't have a finite size, at least not explicitly. Yeah.
I have one question. If you compare this with simple biological calculation, where you model the DNA as having a Henning change charge unit length, and then the K0 Bessel function.
Yeah, well, one of the things I was really hoping to have time to say is that we don't use this Manning idea.
How would the simple biological theory compare with this plot if you look at...
Well, this is the simple.
No, just that for that case. What are you showing there? How would it compare?
I showed you that. That was my homework exercise. It would always look like this. It would always look like this.
You can do the more complicated calculation, which various people have looked at, where you actually keep it as two charges and then try and say what happens after, then of course it depends on orientation.
Oh, you mean with this?
Yes.
I don't know. I don't know. We should do that. Actually, is to set a frame of. That's a good point. Yeah. We need to do that just because again, it's a frame of expectation, and we'll see. You're not going to have all these crossovers, I don't think.
But you get the remote part correctly.
The remote part should be given. We'll see. I'm not willing to say anything now that I haven't done because I think this is subtle enough. Well, I had a feeling that I wouldn't be able to go very much further than this, but I do have some time. I want to give you, if I do have the time, I haven't discussed the theory at all. I just alluded to a point that I did want to make. Trip over this. Maybe I won't. Okay, let's get going. So basic definitions, you know, C, theta, number of condensed counter ions per polymer charge, Q, the internal partition function of the condensed layer, Q prime, renormalized polymer unit charge. So it's 1 minus theta times Q, the unit charge, 1 over kappa, you know. C is the concentration of uncondensed counter ions. So what's actually going into these calculations in terms of free energy components? It's simple, but not so simple. First of all, the renormalized charge repulsions within a polymer segment gives you this. When you just sum the e to the minus kappa r over r's for all distances, for all pairs on one polymer, that's the important point here, you get this expression. Then, skipping down here, there's a transfer of counter ions from the bulk to the condensed layer. If there is a condensed layer, then there has to be a transfer from bulk to condensed. So what I have here is the log of, here's the log C for the uncondensed or bulk, and here's the log of number of condensed counter ions over the internal partition function. Here is where we get a distance dependence, an interaction between if we're talking about this situation, two polymer segments coming together in parallel like this, which is one interesting problem. You get one K naught the Bessel function. If you're talking about the counter ion rod potential of mean force, you still get 1k naught, but then you get just the 1 minus theta not squared, just 1 minus theta linear. If you're talking about a cluster of parallel polymer segments, then you get many of these k naughts, one for each pair of polymer segments. Now, the reason I made that facetious comment that we don't use this Manning rule is because it's true. If we did, this would be the only term. And we would not be able to minimize a free energy. I mean, here's your Manning rule with a particular value for 1 minute. But we don't. We have this, and this is plays a very important role. Because I don't know if I'll get to show you some of the R-dependent results. I should mention that when two charged entities come together in this theory, the value of theta is not a constant. It depends on R. So it's not the familiar 1 minus 1 over C. It depends on the distance between the two charged entities. The other thing I should mention is that the relatively simple case, let's say, counter-ion polymer pair potential. Counter-ion is approaching the polymer. The internal partition function in this theory depends on R. It's polarized. The condensed layer is polarized. So there is a sense in which we have fluctuations. The theory one is not linear because we have an equilibrium, like Andre Liu and Mr. Ha. We have an equilibration. It's like the bifocal theorem. So it's not linear.
Except M does not take into account the interactions between the counter ions themselves.
We don't, yeah. There's no explicit, yeah, that's right, yeah. What was I saying? It's not linear and it's not mean field, at least not in the sense of classic Poisson-Boltzmann mean field, because when we bring a counter ion up to within distance R of a charged rod, it changes the structure of the condensed layer. That's not Poisson-Boltzmann mean field. What it is, I can't tell you, but it's not linear, it's not Poisson-Boltzmann mean field. Now, results for an isolated polymer segment. So, this is the classic result. If C is less than 1, we find theta equals 0 when we minimize. If C is greater than 1, here's your familiar expression. We also get an expression for the internal partition function, and I want to stress that a little bit because I don't think it's been sufficiently noticed. This is a result of free energy minimization. There's remarkably little detail in that expression. What is the internal partition function of the condensed layer? The condensed layer must have a very rich structure. It's interacting with the discrete charges on the polymer. There are local dielectric constants, if you want to use that language. None of that is built in here. This is a consistency rule. If you want to calculate the internal partition function of the condensed layer, So you're going to have many different components to it. And I think you'd better be sure that when all of them are multiplied together to give you your overall partition function, that it satisfies this consistency rule. I do want to leave time for questions, so I'm just going to throw up. Let me just do this. It won't raise any hackles. And then this will be the last transparency. And then we'll see what kind of questions there are. Just to show to go back to my original work in 1969, but this is a 1996 experiment, to show the 69 I derived these limiting laws, polyelectrolyte limiting laws. And this just shows how well they can be satisfied by experimental data. What we have here is the Donnan salt. Here's a reference. It's Donnan salt exclusion. So this is gamma. Donnan system, salt is excluded from the polymer side. Here's your definition. For 1-1 salt, the limiting law says it's 1 over 4 times C minus 1. And here's, it's just a constant. So here's the constant line, the solid line here, and here are the data points. As a function of X, and here's the definition of X, polymer concentration over salt concentration. So here you have low salt concentration on the right, on your left. Here you have low salt concentration, and here you have high salt concentration. Overall, it's a rather low salt, but it's not 10 to the minus 24th. I mean, it's not zero concentration. It's between 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 3. And it's absolutely flat. And what is this expression? What the ideal value, so no electrostatics, is 1/2. That gives you one of these factors. 1 over C, that's the condensed layer. So there's another factor of 1/2. That's Debye-Huckel. That's the Debye-Huckel part of the theory of the limiting law. It's all very close. And I won't, there's no, not time for that. I'll just end now. And see what I have.
For your first problem, I missed a little bit. If you have very, very long DNA, like megabase, and no salt, and it's one side of it is completely or partially neutralized.
Right.
What would be the shape of the DNA?
Well, if it's very long, it has to be restricted to something like a persistence length. If it's very long, it's flexible, and then you can have in mind a flexible polymer picture.
Okay, so you don't have on a persistence length scale. So let's say if you have a persistence length
about 150 base pair, then if the whole thing is neutral, I have the.
But if it's very long,
Or even with salt, it goes down. But it should be rod-like. But it will bend severely according to these calculations. If you neutralize one face, it'll be really big. And I wouldn't believe that I have the numbers there. I wouldn't believe those specific numbers because they're too big.
So if you keep increasing the length of your rod, what would happen?
It would become flexible, and then the whole picture is lost.
Given the charge.
What's the persistence length if there's no salt?
Well, so it's a little over half the square.
What size?
But that's salt. That's when it has salt.
Right.
The kappa.
It
denatures, for one thing. I mean, so. Yeah.
The theory, that simple theory, would say it would be stretched out
into infinity, but I don't believe that.
So theoretically, do you have an answer if it's only one side charged?
But why won't it just essentially bend round, and then once you get to some multiple of the basic stiffness length, it will proceed to oscillate? So you will get something that will be a twisted spiral. I mean, various of these things have been looked at, and on a very, very long scale, they'll be yet. It will look like a random coil, but you'll have to get up to that. But otherwise, it will tend to wind round on itself. All along the scale, if you can keep
If it really were stiff over this long, if it really were, and you're saying suppose it is, then that seems like a reasonable,
But even if it's worm-like, then it'll still have a twist, and you'll get a worm-like chain with a curvature on it. It'll tend to come back on itself.
Locally, you'll have.
Okay, the other, also on the first problem you talked about, you're essentially compressing asymmetrically. Extent of neutralization and bending. You originally mentioned the histone DNA interaction as some general motivation. There you have another landscape in the problem, the radius of the protein
right.
around which the DNA is
Right, yeah.
Have you thought about
Yeah, we've thought about it. We haven't done it. I think we can do it. It'll be a numerical project. I think we can do it. We have done winding, you probably know, winding of DNA modeled just as a single line of charges, not as two lattices around a histone. So I don't see why we can't do two lattices with some more complicated numerical work, and then maybe we can sort out these various contributions. The issue is whether the issue is that if the histone is curved more tightly than the DNA would like to be intrinsically, then you have to pump in more elastic energy into the DNA. It's not it will go up to a point with spontaneously. But even then, it's not too clear because the charges that it's trying to contact are curved away from it. It's not the same problem as lateral neutralization on a straight. Yeah, but it's a related problem. Well, I'm not sure what is in your mind when you say that. I can guess. Would you?
When TDP binds to DNA, it causes a massive break in the molecule.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's thought to insulate into the base.
Yeah. That's the other big bending mechanism that people are talking about, as I understand it. No, I really can't comment about that. I don't believe that this is the only bending mechanism, and I also try to confine myself, although people are pushing. I didn't really want to talk about proteins in that context. I mean, so far our protein is just a plus and a minus.
Yeah.
But that's such a different experiment. So I don't know what point you're. Is it really? Yes. Because the only thing that Strauss and Maher did was to neutralize the charge, and they found anywhere from 5 to 20 degrees of bending, depending on how they neutralized the charge. It's a very simple experiment, and we're just trying to explain that. No, there are as I just said. If you forget the histone, don't push me toward proteins. But Strauss and Maher is part of her pretty extensive thesis. They neutralize in many different ways, and they get many different values for the bending angle. But they're not orders of magnitude. As I recall, there's something like 5 degrees for the weakest effect, and about 21 degrees for the methylation. So yes, there are differences, and then the all-atom simulation also shows the differences which particular oxygen you choose makes
yeah,
doesn't it?
On whether we need to think about the histone DNA interaction as a true disappearance
of the charge. No, I don't want to comment about that. I really don't. That's a deep question.
Actually, the question about your last transparency, that one on your right hand side.
Yeah.
That's right. Silvio May and Daniel, can you show it?
Yeah, sure.
Silvio May and Daniel Harris and Avi Ben-Shaul have done Poisson-Boltzmann calculation of a rod modeling DNA in an oppositely charged plate where a dielectric contrast. And they found a curve very similar to this, and this upturn here seemed to be simply the image charge because there's a dielectric discontinuity at the surface. If you go from a high dielectric,
did they really do the delta G beverage? Because I'm aware of Poisson.
They computed the full Poisson-Boltzmann calculation.
But this is not the full. This is delta G beverage.
I understand.
Yeah, but that's important.
But there are image charges at the surface.
That may be.
I have a repulsive effect if you bring these even though there is an electrostatic attraction, its charges will be repulsive. Because you go from a high dielectric medium to a low dielectric surface, the interior of the DNA here.
Okay.
You're really advocating a different definition of beverage, which I think is, again, arguable in this mind.
Well, there are effects that we don't have.
Because here you see the point he's making. It's not delta F beverage, it's just the energy change.
No, sorry. It's delta G beverage. Right. Beverage would not call it that, of course. I had the chutzpah to, in a derogatory sense, but beverage would not call it delta G beverage.
But have you considered image charges?
No.
From the dielectric contest?
No.
Okay, I think that we thank Professor Mann for the talk.